That's Freddie Hubbard on trumpet opening up with a nifty little tune called Crisis. It's the closing track from his 1961 album, Ready for Freddie, featuring Wayne Shorter on tenor sax, Bernard McKinney on euphonium, McCoy Tyner on piano, Art Davis on bass, and the great Elvin Jones on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. And class is in session today. And what do I mean by that? We'll be talking about empire, racism, and genocide. And we'll be talking about all these three things in the context of U.S. foreign policy. What really informs U.S. foreign policy? Is it noble ideas about fostering freedom and justice and democracy all over the world? No, it isn't. Not at all. So says our guest, peace activist Robert Fantina. He is a peace activist. He has been working on the Palestinian question for a long time. He is the author of a couple of business books. But we're not talking about business today, except the business of policy and getting a sense of what informs U.S. policy. We'll be drawing principally from his most recent book, Empire, Racism, and Genocide, A History of U.S. Foreign Policy. But he also has written other novels, including Look Not Unto the Morrow. It's an anti-war love story. He's also written many articles in left-leaning publications and websites. And you should find out more about this man and his work at Robert Fantina, F as in Frank, A-N-T-I-N-A.com. In fact, it was a title that drew me to make an overture to him and to invite him onto the program. Empire, Racism, and Genocide. These things are not normally considered part of foreign policy. When we talk about foreign policy, we talk generally, or we expect to talk about, you know, what this nation wants of the other nation and, you know, the transactions between nations. But, Robert, first of all, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you. I'm very pleased to be here.
Thank you so much. Now, this is an unusual title. Let's start with that.
Okay.
Why did you select these three particular words, empire, racism, genocide, as being very, very integral to understanding U.S. foreign policy?
Well, I think that throughout history, the United States has always said that its foreign policy is always geared to keep its borders safe and also to protect other vulnerable peoples around the world from oppressive governments, to bring them the same human rights and democracy that the U.S. purports to have. And that's a myth. It does not hold under close scrutiny, that the real reasons are, as the title says, empire. The U.S. wants to have a control everywhere, which is evidenced by the hundreds and hundreds of military bases that are around the world and in other countries. Racism, in showing that the United States always wants to force its particular brand of democracy onto another nation, whether that nation wants it or not, and also coupled with racism and genocide, as the United States invades other countries, as it did, as has countless times, just looking at Iraq for a moment, and killing hundreds of thousands of people. In order for soldiers to be able to do that, they have to stop seeing those people as people. And that's where the racism comes in, because they're taught in military training to see the, quote, enemy as less than human.
In so this regard, though, I mean, it's a very cruel reality, but it is a reality. But is it unique to the United States? These three words, do these three words uniquely apply to the United States? And if so, why did you choose to single them out as being specifically associated with the United States, as opposed to, say, Britain or China or some other country.
Okay, there were a few reasons for that. One is I am a U.S. citizen. Secondly is I am appalled at the hypocrisy. I grew up going to elementary schools and high schools and learning of the greatness of the United States, and it's how generous it was in serving other countries. And then when I was actually researching an earlier book, I was becoming aware of so many things from history that told me that recent events such as the invasion of Iraq or Afghanistan were not unique, that these were just part of an ongoing pattern that's gone on for 200 years. So you're right in saying that it isn't just the United States, but the United States gives itself this reputation and presents itself as not interested in empire, as not being racist, and certainly as condemning genocide, when actually it is guilty of all three. So that was why I singled out the United States, partly because of its hypocrisy and partly because the fact that I am a U.S. citizen.
Well, I'm going to stay close to these three words for a while, taking them in turn. Let's start with the first, empire. What is the meaning of empire, and why do you associate it with the United States and its foreign policy objectives?
Empire, to me, is the policy of a country to rule everywhere, to have colonies throughout the world that it controls, that it takes the natural resources from, that it runs in any way it sees fit, regardless of the desires and wishes and culture of the people who live within that country. We see this everywhere as the United States goes in to install its brand of democracy. In Iraq, there was little, if any, understanding of the language and the customs of the people there. That didn't matter. They simply had to abide by U.S. rules and regulations, and if they didn't, well, they could die. Interestingly, if I could go back in history a little bit to the Philippine-American War, at that time, generals there told the president that the Filipino people were ignorant, that they would only come into subservience to the United States through force, and that force was to be maintained. So no consideration of their own culture or their basic human dignity and civil rights. They were just to be the slaves or the possessions, at least, of their imperial possessors, who was the United States. So that's empire to me, and that's very characteristic of the United States as it goes around the world, overthrowing governments, either covertly or overtly, and installing puppet governments in it that are favorable to U.S. corporate interests, but usually not favorable to the human rights interests of that country's citizens.
At what point would you say, historically speaking, did this concept of empire begin to take shape and to take hold within the United States in terms of, well, we've arrived at a point of critical mass to the point where we can literally envision this? I'm talking about just thinking about how the thinking went. Well, we're big enough now to take on the world, anyone we want in the world. At what point would you say, historically, this concept began to take shape, to become a point of critical mass that it would inform something called foreign policy?
This has its roots in the earliest days of the United States in the concept of manifest destiny. The United States, when it was first founded as 13 colonies and then gained its independence at the expense, I might add, of millions of lives of the Native Americans and the complete destruction of their culture. But the United States has always felt that it was divinely inspired, divinely created to rule the world. In the War of 1812, the goal was the conquest of Canada, which the United States felt was it's due to own Canada. Now, that was, of course, an unsuccessful venture. But as far as when it really became, I think your question about critical mass and so on, during World War II, by the time World War II happened, the United States was large enough and powerful enough and was certainly going to demonstrate its power in the world and establish itself as one of the top world powers. But the idea of having colonies throughout the world, and it's impolite in U.S. society to call them colonies, but that's what they are, began much, much earlier. There were, I mentioned the Philippines. Prior to that, in the late 1800s, the United States manufactured a reason to invade Cuba when the battleship Maine was sunk. So this is not something that is a new concept, although the United States has been able to put it into play much more frequently since World War, or much more successfully since World War II. But even when Texas became a state, and there was a war with Mexico, but the United States felt Texas should be part of the United States, and if the United States believes that, then the United States will go out and get it.
So the parallel struggle now, this is a nation now coming into its own as the elite, the ruling elite sees it. Mm-hmm. We are arriving at a point now where we can do what we want to do. Domestically, yes. How does this concept begin to form and get momentum as a ruling elite? I imagine, you know, the parallel track being that while this concept of what it could do outside of the United States, then comes a question about how and for whom is all of this going to benefit within the United States. So this ruling elite, what is the struggle, the parallel struggle that is occurring in the United States as it gears up to rule the world? How is the discussion going as to who will get to rule the world?
Well, I think the answer to that is really in looking at how the United States has ceased, if it was ever a democracy, it has ceased to be a democracy and is now an oligarchy. So those with the money call the shots and rule the world. We see that more and more with presidential candidates or even candidates for other offices who need vast amounts of money in order to run for office, which removes any real voice in governance from the common man and woman. We also see increasing repression of people of color, of minorities, not only people of color, but religious Muslims and so on. So these people are being marginalized by the very wealthy who have the power. That's shown in some obvious ways, but also in some subtle ways. The fact that it is so expensive for most people to attend college or university these days, they often go into huge debt to the government in order to complete their college educations, which then leaves them vulnerable to government mandate because they owe sometimes hundreds of thousands of dollars to the government for their education. These are not people who are going to make waves because even if they declare bankruptcy, that debt is not forgiven. So this is more and more we're moving to a small number of people, and we're seeing even some families, Clintons, Bushes, and so on, who are taking power and holding on to it and sometimes switching it back and forth, but mainly being the power brokers and the power leaders in the United States.
In this regard, when countries seek to plunder other countries, you know, like in the old Christopher Columbus days where they say, well, look, we can go out and you have our permission. You can decimate entire populations, but bring back the goodies. The notion was that, well, there is a ruling elite. It is identified as such. And to the powerful go all the spoils. I'm thinking that it might have been different in the United States when this was developing, this notion of nationhood and this the coming into being of a power elite. But the coming into being of a power elite is taking place within a domestic conversation that has to do with these high-minded ideals about equality and freedom.
Yes.
And you know, we have stood up to the tyranny of oppression. And whatever it is that we're doing this for the good of all the people of the nation. So how do these things square with each other? Did you find that to be a very interesting contradiction? It has nothing to do with the nation as a whole. It is clearly for a very small population.
Yes, it is. And it's interesting how the United States government and the corporate-owned, corporate-controlled media is able to foster that story and make it so believable that people believe when the United States invades Iraq or when it's sending drones to kill innocent people in various countries, that they're doing it to protect the United States, to protect the common citizen, as if people in some third world country halfway around the world threaten our general security. But by doing so, by invading countries, by arming other countries, repressive countries, the United States accomplishes a few things. It keeps the arms manufacturers happy, and there are people, a few people are making a lot of money from that. And it enables the government to restrict basic rights, that we have widespread surveillance now because we don't know who's the enemy within. And as we look at so-called terrorists around the world, well, who in the United States might be supporting them or might be sympathetic to them, and the only way of learning that is through reading their email, listening to their telephone calls, and so on. So what I'm seeing is that the people are being convinced that there is a threat. They're being convinced by the people who are telling them that there's a threat, and they're going along with whatever those people, the powers that be, want them to do in order to protect them from this imaginary threat. That has gotten worse over time. As you mentioned before, I think initially when the U.S. was expanding, especially across the North American continent, the government wanted to establish critical mass. They wanted to create a wealthy country and have enough people there who were willing to work the land that then the power could grow. But now it's at a point where the country is very rich and is using its power and abusing its power domestically and around the world.
Well, let's move to the second of the three words, and that is racism. Part of the title of the book, Empire, Racism, and Genocide, A History of U.S. Foreign Policy, and our guest is Robert Fantina, the author. How does racism factor into U.S. foreign policy?
It's, I think, a very integral part of it. Right now, for example, anyone who is brown-skinned and is seen as a potential terrorist, anyone who, and this may not be racism, maybe more religious prejudice, but I think I lump them in together, anyone who follows the religion of Islam is suspicious. Racism and prejudices similar to that are just looking at an entire group of people and categorizing them. So we look at, in domestically, young black men wearing hoodies are all at risk from white police officers. So that's not foreign policy, that's domestic policy. But regarding foreign policy, the government can say, well, the people over there in the Middle East, they are all terrorists. They want to destroy the United States. They hate us for our freedoms. Remember, Rudy Giuliani made that astounding statement a number of years ago. when it isn't that hatred for freedoms has nothing to do with it. But by enabling, the United States can invent its enemies using racism. During Vietnam, there were a number of derogatory terms that were used for the citizens of Vietnam. And they were used so that soldiers would not see these people as people, but would see them as somehow less. When the United States invaded during the first Gulf War, there were a number of derogatory terms for Iranians who were fighting and other people in that region, so that Americans could slaughter them and think they were doing nothing wrong. Of course, it doesn't always work, as the instance of post-traumatic stress disorder following deployments to war zones indicates. The United States always wants to install what it calls democracy around the world, thinking or saying at least that the citizens of these other countries that it is forcing itself upon are not somehow capable of managing their own affairs. So I think racism is a very large part of U.S. foreign policy and has been for generations.
And how does that factor into where the United States basically puts its focus in terms of relating to other countries? Is there a correlation between racism at that level and the way the United States engages other countries around the world, whether militarily or through trade or in any other way, but that has the net effect of being a one-sided, oppressive deal?
Yes, I think that the racist attitudes and who, what countries the United States choose to engage with are very closely related. The United States engages in countries where its financial, its profit-making centers or its corporate interests may be threatened. If in South America, for example, some third world country, but some less developed country that installs, democratically elects a leftist leader who may not want to provide the most favorable trade to the United States or may want to nationalize U.S. industries for the good of its own people, then the United States will begin to engage there and to prevent that from happening, and will and the racism comes in that those citizens then become somehow terrorists, less than human, and have to be seen as different from the white establishment in order for soldiers, either invading soldiers from the United States to kill them, or if the United States is covertly destabilizing their government for their own soldiers to kill them. So the racism isn't the main reason for the United States getting involved in any country or engaging in any country, as I see it. It's usually related to corporate interests, and racism and genocide become byproducts of that.
Well, let's move on to that word, genocide, and U.S. foreign policy. How are they related?
Oh, they are so closely related. It must be remembered, the United States recently, with five other nations, came to an agreement with Iran that would regulate Iran's nuclear program to assure that it is only for peaceful reasons. We have to remember that only one country has ever used nuclear weapons. That is the United States. That those 2 days of bombs dropped in Japan killed way over 100,000 people immediately, and hundreds of thousands of more who died horrific deaths following that as a result of those bombs. Now, this was a time when there was great hatred against the Japanese or towards the Japanese due to the bombing of Pearl Harbor and other and the war itself. And in any war, the U.S. will foster hatred for the opposing side. So this can only be seen, the killing of this many people when Japan was very close to surrender. There were a couple of points they didn't want the their emperor to be executed. That was one of the few last points, but to drop these bombs and kill this many people can only be seen as genocidal. We can also look to, I mentioned the Philippines before, when entire villages, men, women, and children, were all slaughtered simply because they were Filipino. In Iraq, I mentioned before, again, there was no or little consideration of their own cultures, understanding of their cultures. They either did as they were told or they died. So genocide is seen in that regard, and also in the support that the United States gives to other countries. And I will mention now Israel, which has been striving to wipe Palestine off the map for something nearly 80 years, taking their lands, killing their people, all with U.S. financing. So the U.S. is in no position to take the moral high ground when it comes to condemning other countries for genocide or even for human rights violations.
This may sound as an awkward question, but is there such a thing as a high-minded, just, fair, humane foreign policy? I mean, given the way the world is today, is it possible to fashion such a thing in the ways that the United States deals with other nations, given its history, given its temperament, given the reality of what it perceives foreign policy is for? I had a talk recently with General Wesley Park, Clark, sorry. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to get into what do military people of his stature, because he was high up in the military, mm-hmm. Supreme commander of NATO. What is the thinking at that level? How do you perceive the world? Just to get a sense. And he said it's very simple. We get orders about what the president and others want to get done. And then we tell them how to do it, and we tell them how much it would cost. Now, part of that, of course, a missing element of all of this was not any thought given to the morality of the action mm-hmm. or anything like that. It's just cut and dried business. This is our business. This is what the military does. So I'm asking a question in the arena of foreign policy akin to that. If, in fact, foreign policy is being shaped by a government that has a propensity toward dominance, world dominance, which tells you the psychological mindset, yes. Is there any reason to hope that out of such a mindset could come a logical, humane way of dealing with the rest of the world? Or is it permanently from the point of view of the first word, empire?
Yes, I'm sorry to say, but I'm realistic enough to say that without a fundamental shift, that there is not going to be a change, that the policy or the model that Mr. Clark described that you've just related to us is the one that is going to continue. The president and his various advisors will decide what they want to do, whether that's a pipeline through Afghanistan that the Taliban won't allow, therefore Afghanistan needs to be invaded, or perhaps a lobby group that needs to be satisfied in order to keep political contributions flowing. These are the considerations that the United States prioritizes. So the fundamental shift would need to be towards human rights and human dignity. It's been said that the world hunger could be solved by redirecting the U.S. military budget. So rather than killing people, that money could be used to feed the world. When one thinks of the amount of money spent, say, in Iraq during that war in just 1 year, hundreds of thousands of students could have had, in the United States, could have had 4-year education's free. Healthcare could have been greatly expanded, but that isn't what suits the powers that be. They want to increase their wealth and power around the world, and by keeping people in the United States poor and vulnerable, and certainly by keeping people in other nations poor and at risk, it suits their purposes far more than giving them basic human rights and recognize their dignity as human beings would do. So, unfortunately, the answer to your question, will there be a, is a different foreign policy possible? I think the answer is not without a fundamental shift in the initial thinking of those in governance.
Well, the unfortunate thing is that in the system of government in which we exist, we, quote, the people, unquote, we don't have anything to do with foreign policy. We barely have to do with actually electing a democratic government. We barely have that. And some people would insist that we don't have that at all. We just have this symbolic gesture. Mm-hmm. But clearly, foreign policy is completely outside of our ability to formulate or to enact. So this shift that you're talking about, in what ways could it begin to take shape? What has to happen, you think?
Well, what would have to happen would be a recognition in the United States that the U.S. manufactures its enemies for its own purposes and then fights those enemies. There would have to be a belief among the people that they aren't quite as vulnerable as the government would make them believe. Iraq did not have weapons of mass destruction. There needs to be that recognition that, and this is very trite to say, but that we are world citizens more than we are U.S. or Canadian citizens or whatever else we might be, and that people around the world basically want the same things we want, which is to live their lives in peace, to regulate the way they live their lives, and to manage their own governmental affairs. So until people in the United States begin to accept that, and begin to accept the fact that by the U.S. forcing their brand of living on other countries, this is not something other countries want, and isn't what's good in one country and works in one country doesn't necessarily in another, whose culture is different, whose religious practices may be different, whose history is different, then we can start to see a shift, because then people will demand that their candidates discuss these things. Right now, the only thing people want to hear, and we hear this at the Republican debate, and there's another one, I think, tonight.
Yeah, we call it the Q&A.
The Q&A, right, where they talk about building a wall between the United States and Mexico. One candidate who has since dropped out, this is Mr. Walker, said that we have to consider a wall between Canada and the United States. Now, I'm a dual citizen, Canada and the United States, and why do people think that a wall between any two countries is going to make any huge difference? Why are we so afraid of everybody? So until that fear begins to cease, and it won't be soon, because the government fans the flames of fear because it is their advantage to do so. It maintains the status quo.
Well, the government still has the advantage. It's been at this for a long, much, much longer than the opposition of people trying to steer it in the other direction. So do you see any sense, do you get any sense, I should say, that the resistance is having effect, or that is building to have effect?
I think it is building, and I think the reason for that is the growth of social media. And, of course, the United States is trying to control the Internet. Hasn't been successful in doing that yet. But I think we are seeing more education, because people aren't simply relying on Fox News or MSNBC or whatever it is, since they're all basically the same. They're not They don't need to simply rely on that. If I can give an example, last summer of 2014, when Israel was carpet bombing the Gaza Strip. Now, this is a rich country that is completely supported by the United States, that has all the weaponry the United States can give it, bombing heavily oppressed people who have no army, navy, or air force. The media talked about some ineffectual rockets sent, shot from Hamas into Israel, and said next to nothing about the slaughter of the Palestinians. However, more and more people were seeing that on various social media sites, Facebook, Twitter, and others, and were learning that there is more going on than they were aware of. This has seemed to have caused a shift in support. Support for Israel is somewhat diminished. Support for Palestinians has somewhat grown. I don't think that ever would have happened if people were relying simply on the news media. We also have the Occupy movement, which was growing for several weeks before it was ever reported on the corporate-owned, if I could call it that, media. And these things are beginning to create knowledge in people and awareness, and people are starting to question more than they have for a long time, I think. So I see that as a good sign. I would like to see it happen overnight. That's not going to happen. But I do see that that there is momentum building.
What, from the point of view of the book, yes, what would you say, because you didn't quite actually identify or hone in, you were quite comprehensive, but I'm just going to ask you about, in your view, what could you cite as perhaps the worst foreign policy failure in recent memory?
The worst one in recent memory. There's so many to choose from. It's difficult. We could certainly talk about the invasion of Iraq, which I think it was then Vice President Dick Cheney said that the Iraqis would cheer in the streets for the U.S. soldiers, that the war would be over in a short time with very few casualties. The war dragged on for years. There were over 4,000 U.S. casualties. Estimates range up to 1 million Iraqi deaths, more than several million Iraqis displaced from their homes, driven into refugee camps. The destabilization of Iraq, where different sects had been able to live together in relative harmony for generations, and then this brought out hostilities again. And the goal of that was to rid Iraq of weapons of mass destruction, which it didn't have. Now, this was a foreign policy disaster in so many ways, some that I've mentioned, but additionally, Hans Blix from the Nuclear Regulatory Agency was, and his inspectors were going through Iraq. They were getting unprecedented access to any site they asked for, and looked for these weapons of mass destruction. And then, just prior to the invasion, President Bush told them to leave or risk their lives because he was sending his bombs. Now, from start to finish, this was just a disaster. Disaster politically, disaster from a human rights standpoint, from the standpoint of international law. So that is one of the many foreign policy disasters that comes to mind. And if I had to pick the worst one in the last generation or two, I think I would pick that one.
Could I ask you to talk a bit about yourself and your own journey as an activist, especially dealing in this realm of foreign policy? What was your own personal evolution here? And how did you come into this messed up world of foreign policy?
Well, it's interesting that you asked that. I grew up in the United States in a very politically conservative family, and began questioning those philosophies in my teens. And then perhaps 15 years ago, I had read some stories of deserters from different wars, you know, 10 to 15 years ago from Iraq and so on. And I read their stories, and they seemed to be such honorable people. And so I started researching desertion from the history of the United States, from the American Revolution. And what I found was that while I was told in my growing up years that in every school I went to that deserters were either cowards or traitors, that was the only reason for desertion, I learned through my research that most deserters, with few exceptions, had very legitimate and honorable reasons for deserting. So as I continued to look through and cover every time period I could from the American Revolution to the Iraq War, which was going on at the time I wrote that book on desertion, and I found out, I saw more information about foreign policy, about the reasons soldiers were deserting were often based on foreign policy decisions that had sent them into war zones. So then I started delving into foreign policy, which led me to writing the book Empire, Racism, and Genocide. And the things I saw did surprise me, did astound me. I was under the impression that the United States in its early history had been more honorable than I found that it was. And I found out that it's been basically what the United States is doing now is what it's always done. But that basically is how I came to be involved in foreign policy and to begin studying and learning all that I could about that topic.
But in this realm, I've been reading some of your work, and you have identified one person who is not so honorable, and that is Hillary Clinton.
Oh, yes.
what is your beef with Hillary?
How much time do we have? My beef with Hillary is that former Senator Clinton is an opportunist. She is an imperialist. She will sell her soul to the highest bidder. She has demonstrated that. She's demonstrated her disdain for international law and for human rights by her unqualified support of Israel. And she has she has simply demonstrated when she was Secretary of State, she was being lobbied by a number of different corporations, mostly oil companies and defense contractors. And one would think, now the lobbying is subtle. She was Secretary of State. She, I'm sure, never accepted a dime from anybody.
Not at all.
But there is a Clinton Foundation. The charitable foundation of Bill and Hillary, which did accept millions of dollars. And I think there's too close a link there to, I'm not questioning in any way Mrs. Clinton's, as I said, I'm sure she's never taken a penny. But when the charity that bears her and her husband's name is accepting millions of dollars from corporations that the Secretary of State could benefit, I think that's crossing a line that shouldn't be crossed. So, also, I believe Mrs. Clinton seems to have a sense of entitlement that it's her turn. She lost out last time because then-Senator Obama, with his eloquent rhetoric, upstaged her. But I think now she's thinking this is her time. She is raising, I've read she may raise as much as $1 billion for this campaign. So again, as I mentioned earlier, it's whoever has the money buys the office. So my complaints about Mrs. Clinton are numerous.
And in this regard, you mentioned President Obama. I want to come back to this notion about foreign policy doesn't shift too much. I mean, in the sense of you of the way you have identified the formation of this concept of foreign policy, what its aims and objectives and purposes are, do you find that it remains remarkably consistent irrespective of who is in office, whether it's a Democrat, a Republican, liberal, conservative, that the foreign policy objective, once it was fashioned, has remained remarkably steady and unchanged.
Yes, I agree with that completely. And that goes back to what we mentioned as far as the mindset of the U.S. government, that its goal and purpose is world domination through a variety of methods. And that doesn't change. There are subtle differences between one president and another, between the two parties, and unfortunately there isn't a third, viable third party. But it does stay the same, and we can see that with the wars that were started during George Bush's presidency. They were continued during President Obama's. President Obama has expanded wars into his drones and invasions in ostensibly fighting or supporting the rebels in Syria and in opposing ISIL. The bombing continues regardless of who is president, regardless of which party is in power. The destruction, the death continues. There is, it is frustrating because we have two parties to vote for. I believe that Mrs. Clinton will be the Democratic candidate. I don't know who the Republicans will run yet, but there won't be a lot of strong differences between them. There might be in social issues, things like reproductive health, marriage equality, and so on. But as far as foreign policy is concerned, there isn't going to be a lot of difference because each candidate has to wave their I'm strong in defense flag because it sells so well with the U.S. populace.
The other thing that has gotten, I would say, almost equal attention from you is the question of Palestine. Why have you focused there?
Over the years, I would hear news stories, just watch the news, and there would be a quiet comment, three more Palestinian homes were bulldozed today, and they go on to something else. And I didn't pay attention for far too long, and then I started paying attention, and I was wondering why that was, and I began doing research without any particular position, because I had none. And what I saw was brutal oppression from the very beginnings of the State of Israel, when over 700,000 Palestinians were driven from their homes to make room for it. And then since then, the ongoing the occupation of the West Bank, the checkpoints, the killing with complete impunity, the settler violence against Palestinians in the West Bank, the blockade of the Gaza Strip, which allows very little to be imported. I'm in contact with several people in the Gaza Strip, and no rebuilding has happened because, although some countries have promised several million dollars to the rebuilding effort, Israel will not allow the supplies to enter. So tens of thousands of people are still homeless. The destruction of the buildings is still all there. So I have become very much involved in this, and I do write about it significantly. I think this is also another foreign policy blunder of the United States. The U.S. vetoes any U.N. resolution that would criticize Israel for its behaviors in Palestine. And this has continued and has not changed under President Obama.
Now, is the United States the only nation at this time interested in world domination and empire? Would you say China is doing the same? Would you say Russia? Would you say Japan? Is the U.S. alone in this class?
The U.S. probably isn't alone, but the U.S. has positioned itself so that it is more able to continue with an imperial agenda by having bases around the world, Air Force or military bases around the world, more so than any other nation, by having the financial means to wage its wars wherever it wants to, more than any other nation does at this time, by having the technology, the weaponry, although certainly other nations are catching up, and some have probably bypassed the U.S. in that, but there's kind of been a perfect storm of opportunity for the United States over the years to position itself to continue with imperial wars and covert activities that lend themselves to the U.S. maintaining power through puppet governments in other countries.
So which has given you greater satisfaction, writing about business or writing about foreign policy?
Well, one has to make a living. So... But oh. Yes, my work on foreign policy and on peace and human rights, of course, has far more satisfaction for me. That is the place where I think at some point I might at someday be able to make some kind of small difference, and that's what I do it for.
And I think you're well on the way to doing that, because the book is an intriguing book. I encourage people
Thank
to
you.
Get a copy. Empire, Racism, and Genocide, A History of U.S. Foreign Policy, by our guest, Robert Fantina. You can get to know more about Robert Fantina by going to his webpage, Robert Fantina, F as in Frank, ANTINA.com. I want to thank you so much for making yourself available for a whole hour here with us today on Lead Stories, and for bringing to our attention this very vital aspect of foreign policy, and for those three words. I think it's a perfect title: Empire, Racism, and Genocide, A History of U.S. Foreign Policy. Thank you so much, Robert, for being with us today.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Thank you. And that brings us to the end of the program today. I hope it was illuminating. It was for me. I enjoyed it. And I always do this because, you know, we're in class all the time. We are learning all the time, and we are learning from people who are well-situated to be very good guides and teachers. And we exchange information, we share information, we share what we know, and it's all, as you just heard, it's all about making a difference right where you are with what you have. So thank you so much. A pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. Keep it right here, because coming up next is the NDC Savings Club. We'll see each other tomorrow. Bye-bye.